When I began my travels in 81, I had a job teaching on the reservation in San Diego County. And I had an idea to go out and make things for the Native community across the country. And ever since I've been a young man, young boy, my grandmother taught me how to make things, all the stuff. And I always wanted to make things as old as I could. And this flute is 25 years after I started making flutes. I made a flute out of a stick, an apple branch. And this is as old as I can make the flutes. It would be done before you had knives and saws. And I made it to balance the sound to the length and the characteristics of the branch. My parents told me that everything I did caused an effect in the air currents and in the emotions of the people that I met. The actions that I have with people caused them to respond. So you can't walk through life without making a difference, without impacting your actions on anybody else. So this flute is as old as I can get. When I was 13, my family moved from Niagara Falls, New York, out to Los Angeles. And I remember coming down the hill in El Cajon Pass, going to San Bernardino and going on the freeway towards Los Angeles. We stopped 30 miles before we got to Los Angeles, and my dad got a job as a carpenter. And at that time, all of the fields were still grapes and orange groves, and now there's maybe one field of orange groves in Southern California, and it's a park, what used to be there. Going from that time to now, when I was out there, I was always having this dream, and as I got older in the 90s, the dream kept coming back that what would it take for this country to crash? If you live in LA, you live in a desert. You live 200 miles from the nearest running creek. You live 200 miles from the Colorado River, which takes so much water out of the river that by the time it hits the Baja Peninsula, the water's underground. If there was an earthquake that toppled like San Francisco, the water mains would break and everybody would be scrambling. And it would cause a big riot, worse than the last one. There would be people trying to get out to water, and people would be shooting people from the roofs, controlling everything they could. There's canyons that go up into the hills that you can see all the signs of the people that have staked their claim already that when this happens, we're protecting this area. I had friends that we would meet. If this happened, we'll meet at this point and then we'll keep going. This week, I found on the internet that the Lake Superior, the water has risen 4 degrees and is lower this year than ever before. We're not as rainy this year. We're protected by the Great Lakes. That kind of diffuses all the weather coming by. It's the edges that get the weather along the Pennsylvania border and north of, north in Montreal. They get all the brunt of all the storms. What we're doing is we can't eat the fish in Lake Ontario. Last week they said the fish are no longer capable. We're not supposed to eat them. We're running out of time. We're running out of time to make a difference. And nobody is saying that. Nobody in government is saying that other than global warming. And that's not far enough. That's not a statement far enough. We live at the top of the pyramid, this country. When our capability of growing things and sharing those things, which we don't do, when that system is stopped, then the whole world stops. We don't share enough. The land I live on at the share farm is established as a share farm. People come and work and help, and they share in not the profits, but the raspberries and the garlic and the Macintosh apples. And we try to get people aware of the waters. I've been to conferences at Cornell on the waters. They want to mine the waters, private companies, corporations, make it their own. We have to pay for well water, drinking water, tap water in a bottle. All that stuff is what you were talking about. NAFTA, corporations. The first person that tried to start a generator from Niagara Falls started a small town called Model City, just outside of Lewiston, New York. And that's just over the escarpment. And he had a whole housing plan with electricity coming from Niagara Falls. And the big guys just wouldn't pay him, wouldn't give him any money until they controlled it. They controlled it, then it got established, the generator and the power. That's what's going on now. The gas prices are high enough so they can take those monies, and they're artificially keeping the prices up so they can reinvest and keep that money going into fuel cells, electric cars, because they're not going to let small people, small businesses do that. At Model City, You have the American flag standing there, New York State flag standing there, and modern disposal. Those flags are all in a row at the same level. And if anybody's been in the Army, you know what that means. It means they're the same level. The corporations are the same level as the nations. And we're letting that happen. There's a lot of things that have started with us that have been changed. And part of that is the laws that affect all of us now have started from small tribes losing court cases all around the country that opened the door for everybody else to have the same things. Loss of this separation of the church. Now you can't make a political statement in the church without fear of losing your 501c3. You can't, if you can't speak up about something that's wrong, that's censorship. The fashionistas were the first ones to go in a concentration camp along with the Jews. The arts, those people, that whole culture. I've had a lot of people tell me they see the same things. They see the 30s now. I see that. Was never there. But to me, that's what's happening. As one of the smaller minorities in this country, it's been on us. All this weight has been on us. And we keep trying to say this. What are you guys doing? You can't do it this way. You're going to suffer the consequences of polluting the water, polluting the land. It's going to keep on rolling. When Chernobyl happened, the United States was protected because the storm system went up China and back around. Instead of coming straight across into the United States, it went north over the North Pole and back into Europe. Just a little whirlpool. In the book, The Day Before Tomorrow, the storm patterns that are in that book are what we're seeing now. They're coming. And they keep getting worse and worse. What affects somebody on the other side of the world, when Saddam burnt the oil fields, I was flying in a plane from LA to here a week and a half later, and there was smog at the level like this, the level of the plane. And it was oil smoke. That was here. Part of my teachings is that everything has a voice. Foam, wood, melon, everything has a voice. Digitally, we're taught that. They can finally prove that digitally, everything has its own voice. Things my grandparents taught me. I can't walk anywhere without leaving a trace of me. CSI proves that. Those things that my grandmother taught me were before this. This is made out of cherry wood. And to me, the sound speaks for itself. Thank you. I had an idea for a book last month. I keep coming down this way to go to water meetings at Cornell. We're trying to work with all the nations in the Great Lakes to stop privatization of the waters. Make people aware of this, because it is coming. They want to dredge the St. Lawrence so they can bring bigger ships in, take more water and take it elsewhere, take more coal out of the land and take it elsewhere. They're taking from the Yukon River to Manitoba to the Lake Superior, they're taking water. And that will go into Chicago and out west. They say it's not being done on a larger scale, but it is going to be. They're just laying the groundwork. Taking water from where it isn't, that's one thing, but as the community that lives around the Great Lakes and in the watershed, we're going to be the last, and that's going to be worse than oil, that fight. If we don't make good, sustainable plan for that water, it's going to be wasted. We have to think and we have to act. 7 generations. How many have 3 generations here? Are you 3rd generation or do you have 3 generations? You have 3 generations. How old are you? If you live another 40 years, you can have 5 generations. I realized that a couple years ago and somebody said, an old girlfriend said she was a great-grandmother. And I'm not that old. But you can see 5 generations. What you plan for them, if you don't plan anything, it's not going to be there for them. That's how short these generations are beginning. So sustainability is thinking that far ahead. Can we clean up what is here in Cayuga Lake in 150 years? Can we stop all the runoff, all that stuff? My idea for the book was the salt mines collapsed. The water got in there from the lake and it created a salt river down into St. Lawrence. And then the sharks came up. And when you went swimming in the salty Cayuga, you had to watch out for sharks. That's how come I quit surfing, because I had all these dreams about sharks. I've been in the water since, though. And I went there a couple years ago and got in the water in Newport Beach. And the people I was with said, "We saw fins behind you." And I'm hoping they were dolphins. I don't know if you know, but for Iroquois, if you have dreams, you're supposed to act them out, or they're telling you something. So, I'll go back in the water still, but, you know, I ended up moving back here. As I'm moving back here, I see the forges in Kansas, the big forges from Chicago that used to be in Buffalo. And they're going west on the interstate. And I'm going, I've never seen plants out there. They tore Kaiser Steel down in Fontana. There's no big steel mills out there. And I realized they were going to China. All those crucibles went to where there's no EPA rules. There's no rules over there. The things that they're doing there we're getting back in dog food and all that stuff. You can't control the waste. You do things that'll harm this generation, it's going to harm the next generation. There's too much to think about. Thank you.
Dan Hill, Cayuga Nation representative to the Haudenosaunee Environmental Task Force. You're listening to a panel on the politics of sustainability from the 2007 New York Green Fest held in and around Ithaca, New York, 2 weeks ago. The panel continued with questions from the audience. The first question was addressed to Dan Hill, asking for more information on the land claims of the Haudenosaunee Nations and the anti-casino activism among traditional Haudenosaunee.
More about the land claims and stuff like that.
I was just reading a lawyer's opinion on where we are right now. And everything, 1974, there was a meeting in Salt Lake City for all the county officials that surrounded Indian Territory. They all went there. Two Navajo people went from Arizona, and they wouldn't let them in. Since then, all the court decisions have gone against Native people to get us to this point now where there's only tobacco, gas, or casinos as entities that we can make a living in. We, the Cayugas, don't have gambling in their lifestyle. It's only one place that it's supposed to be, and that's in a midwinter ceremony. The other faction of the Cayuga Nation is still pursuing a casino. And they are not the traditional Cayugas. We are a traditional government. We have chiefs, clan mothers, faith keepers, and seat warmers as part of the council. There's two seat warmers and a removed seat warmer on the other side. So they are the ones pushing the casino for Cayugas. And the federal government, because all of this effort has been made across the country to terminate Indian nations. There's a bill in Congress right now to terminate the Cherokees. There's incursion of federal law on EPA standards that if we do not act, they will take claim to that. I mentioned that I don't think anybody that was tribally associated would have a less than zero. We don't want no pollution in the waters. You know, if you're going to create something, make sure that what you do is controlled. But right now, the casinos and stuff, they're not going to work. They don't have a consensus. They're trying to run with the consensus that they have. But the traditional government, which is what the Cayuga Nation is, it's not there. And so what you're hearing is all the outside interests spending their money to force a casino. And there's a lot of other factors there too. So but as far as the traditional government, which is what we're still recognized as, that's not going to work. Yes. Yeah, they're a traditional government. And Mazie is the one that put Ray Halbritter as a seat warmer, and then he got federal recognition for that and ran off and did the casino. It's not a business. There's only maybe less than a fourth of those casinos make money. The rest are all too far away from communities to have a viable casino. Like I said before, what affects us affects you guys. Our kids, some of them want the casino, but when you look at everybody else's kids, they're all showing the bling. They're all showing, you know, fast cars, fast clothes, everything. It's that way. The immigration acts, are we going to put our kids working out there in the fields? Is that a viable option? Somebody else answered it.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Yes.
Do as good a job as Dan. The people who lived here in the Americas before we came understood what was sustainable. What I often say, but I didn't say, but thanks for the opportunity, I will do so. Even though my small company does renewable energy, I'm the first to tell people that there is no amount of technology that can rescue us from the situation in which we find ourselves now. Technology is not going to save us, not this time. What has to change is our point of view, our attitudes toward other people, toward our environment, and a deep, deep understanding of our connection to everything that exists. Everything. Dan says everything has a voice. He's right. Physicists know that everything here is made of energy. That's all it is. Matter is just a special form of energy. We don't understand why it exists. We don't understand why we're here. Physicists aren't that smart. Those are metaphysical questions. But we're all connected by virtue of being energy. Our energy field overlaps with everything else, and not only on this planet, throughout the entire universe does your energy field expand, exist. It's a very difficult concept, but it's true. So what's the vision? The vision is deciding, and it's a personal decision for each of us, how much is enough. Does it take 7.2 kilowatts to light this room? No, it should take about 0.2 kilowatts to light this room. We thought about it. Do we need this room? Do we need this building? Do we need all the buildings we have? Do we need all the cars we have? Do we need all the stuff that we have? No, we don't. We need to learn how to get along. We need to learn how to control our population. We need to know that we're part of the Earth, not separate from it. Really, really difficult questions, because they involve changes to our own lives, first of all. If we change ourselves, people will take note, and it will become a cultural phenomenon. We're social creatures. Your neighbor looks at what you're doing. Maybe they might consider changing themselves. I really, really believe that things happen first with us, and they spread out, just like our energy fields, to everywhere else.
My dad was a Baptist minister, and I've heard the story of the Bible for a long time, all my life. And we always say, we originated here, Central America, South America, and went this way. And there is a book out that by blood DNA proves the fact that we originated here and went that way instead of coming this way. We'll never see that again, where this land is without power, not without big catastrophes. Living in LA, you can imagine everybody doing rollerblades and bicycles on the freeway. That would work. People would live longer. They'd be in better shape. Be no smog. But smog's here. In Lake Ontario, you look over on the escarpment, you can see smog. Since I've been living here in
Union Springs for 2 years, myself, I've noticed that I don't drive as much. I'm not on the road every day. And when I do go on a road, I have to make 4 stops to make it worthwhile. I'll put off going to get groceries for an extra day just so I don't go back and forth twice. Because the cost of gas in my truck is too much. But we all have different things that we can give up that will work. In that, what is it, that the movie of Al Gore, I thought he let people off too lightly. Change your light bulb, that's all you know. I was in Germany, and everybody ran by train. Everybody went everywhere by train. We can't do it here too bad. We could do it, but not like it is over there. It's a smaller community. But we do need to make those changes. We do need to be able to have an alternative to driving my truck 4 or 5 times a week, you know. All of us need to make some adjustment. And I think we are a little bit, but I don't know. There's a lot of things that are happening, and it's too hard for me to speculate on what is right to do there. Personally, I would like to see everybody walking. You know, that would make a difference. But then, at the same time, if it was real fast, the country wouldn't last. Because we know who we are. We have armies because we know who we are. Right? But, I don't know, I could get real political right there and say starting a war is different than, you know.
Maybe the country doesn't need the rest. Maybe that's part of the problem. It's too big. It's too unified. Maybe it needs to break into smaller units.
That's being planned. The metro area of the Northeast is already being planned. Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, New York, Pennsylvania. That's one entity. And that's only for economics. They just announced that this week. But they got one going from Chicago to Toronto. That's another metropolitan area that's going to be, and that's what NAFTA does, sets aside economic areas, right?
Yeah. We're running out of time, so I want to ask Virginia Rasmussen a question, and if you want to change the question or give the answer that you would like to give, fine with me, because we're running out of time. What I'd like to know, what we do after the weekend, on Monday, to assert people power as against corporate power?
Well, I will answer that. I would just like also to add some things to what Dan and Art had to say, because I think some of the points they're made that reflect Dan's connections to nature, to water, to cleanliness. Art's point about the importance of asking what is enough and our responsibility for asking and answering that question at every turn. I think one of the ways we can help ourselves figure out what is sustainable is to look to the processes of nature. Nature figured out a long time ago kind of how to function sustainably. What are those processes? They relate to balance, to everyone having a niche and a way to participate. They relate to community and mutuality, giving and taking. They relate to closing cycles, not wasting. They relate to income energy and not capital energy, not fossil fuels and things in the bank, so to speak. And of course, nature has its mystery, and we have our spirituality, which must mirror that mystery. So if our processes mirror nature's processes, I think that gives us a very good guideline to try to figure out what's going to work and what's not going to work over time. What do we do Monday morning? Now there's a challenging question. As I say, I mean, the first thing, of course, is to read the news differently in these times. Notice the power that is being wielded by corporations. The newspaper doesn't even talk about corporations. What do they say? They say industry. They say big business. Look at a whole article that relates to, you know, they'll talk about big oil. You don't see the word corporation very often at all. They talk about Philip Morris. They talk about, you know, citizen corporation of some sort. It's the corporate form that has this legal power. And it literally is a legal power that's far in excess of our own. So what we have to do Monday morning, number one, is help ourselves and other people understand the powers that they really do have over us. This is, you know, talk about it, read about it, engage about it. We don't do that very much in this country around our dinner tables with guests or even our family. So that's number one. And the other one is, in the organizations that we have in our communities, and some of them are national and so forth, what they are doing in a focused way, as I talked a bit about in the talk, in my comments, is they are doing rights-based organizing. So there is a corporate assault in their community, and they want to do something about it. How many of our communities have those assaults of one sort or another going on? Against the water, against the air, against the economy, you name it. We've all got examples very nearby of a corporate assault on our community. Whose right is it to define our community? It's our right, not the corporation's right. And so as we organize to remove that assault from our midst, we want to organize around our rights, even though we don't have them right now because we gave them, somebody gave them away. We've got to get them back. And one of the best ways to help ourselves understand how to do that is through rights-based organizing. Don't just ask a corporation, please behave better. Would you sign, please, this code of conduct? We'd so appreciate it. You know, corporate social responsibility, kick the habit. It's bad business. Corporations cannot be responsible. They cannot be accountable. A corporation is a thing. It's a legal fiction. We are accountable. The people are responsible to one another to instruct their corporations what they intend for them to do. Because you can be sure, right? If we don't instruct them, they're going to instruct us.
That was Virginia Rasmussen, one of the participants in a panel on the politics of sustainability held at the 2007 New York Green Fest, August 10 through 12, in and around Ithaca, New York. Thanks to festival organizer Rachel Treichler for this and all her work. We'll conclude the program with an excerpt of a talk by Julian Darley, founder of the Post-Carbon Institute. The Post-Carbon Institute is focused on relocalization efforts, and Darley will speak a bit about their new experiment, an energy farm in Sebastopol, California.
The grand challenge to us as human beings now, especially industrialized ones, but all of us, is can we imagine sustained ways of living, ways of provisioning ourselves, that's really what the economy is about, that actually lives within our means. Now, let's look at one of the limiting factors, which some of you may already be very familiar with, perhaps even all of you, but forgive me if I just mention again, just to remind us, because there are a few new bits to the oil situation, even in the last couple of days. A discovery of oil peaked in 1930, and even the most hardline economist can surely be persuaded of the idea that before you extract oil, produce it, as it's called in the industry, before you can extract it, you really ought to try and find it. So what's so important about this is you can see that the pattern of discovery makes this kind of mountain shape or a bell curve shape, if you like, here. And it's interesting how the pattern of extraction or discovery so closely follows this. This projection from Colin Campbell of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, this projection suggests that we would peak in all liquids by about 2010. But I think that there's increasing evidence to suggest that we're peaking around about now. And why do I say that? None other than the International Energy Agency, based in Paris, representing the 26 OECD countries and typed and set up as a sort of energy watchdog, hasn't been doing a frightfully good job lately, but they've just sort of started changing their tune even in the last 24, 48 hours, and a couple of graphs will show why they're so worried. This is the historical oil supply up to and including the first quarter of this year. And you can see under that circle there that production to any pair of eyes surely is in a plateau now. And in fact, it's actually declined from that a peak there in 2006. So I think we can see very clearly that unless something dramatic happens, the production's in a plateau. Now, look very carefully at the following chart from the same organization, which predicts demand for the rest of this year. That plateau, by the way, is plateauing at about just over 85 million barrels a day. Now, look at this. That is a projection for the last three quarters of this year. And you'll notice a staggering increase in demand, rising through 86 million barrels a day, so that by the end of this year, we are looking at an oil demand, of just over 88 million barrels a day. Now, you've just seen that oil production has plateaued at 86 million barrels a day, or 85.5. Where's it all going to come from? And just in the last couple of days, the International Energy Agency announced quietly that they don't know. They just say in a little paragraph that anyone can go and visit on the web, they just say in a little paragraph that there is going to be a shortfall in production for this year and that they're going to be calling on the Middle Eastern countries to bring into play their spare capacity, and in the next sentence they say, but the trouble is, we don't really think that spare capacity is there anymore for various reasons. So there, in a little paragraph, just tucked away, is the prediction that before the end of this year, that peak oil will explode onto the screens of just about everybody in the world. I'm going to spend the rest of the time here talking about, in more detail, about relocalization and some of the programs and ideas that we've developed to help us all relocalize. That is to say, getting our daily needs from within the locale as much as we possibly can. Relocalization, or global relocalization, which means doing it on a wide scale, means working to rebuild and retrofit our communities based on the local production of food, energy, and other necessities. The shortening of supply chains, this is absolutely vital. The closing of loops on our vital needs, which means trying to keep good things within the community as much as possible. And for instance, particularly not letting money flow out into the greater global system where you don't tend to see it again. It will mean, over a period of time, moving from a fuel to a foot economy. Before petroleum came along, we all basically ran on muscles. They may have been horses or oxen or our own, but that's mainly what we had. We Brits brought in some coal and some steam and so forth and began this whole industrializing process off. But that way of life, as I said, is going to go away during this century. And one of the ideas that I want to promote is what was the case before 1850 is that communities were based on 5-minute walking distance. That's about a quarter of a mile. The thing to aim for is getting your daily necessities from within a quarter of a mile radius. that can be done. It is done. It's done in Europe, and I lived it for 5 years. It's definitely possible, but it's a bit unusual in North America, but that's where we should be aiming. The relocalization of energy. The first big key to energy, as to everything else, is to reduce consumption. And that is going to mean taking part in a planned contraction of your dependence, of our dependence, on the global economy. Because I believe it is true to say the global economy is going to go into a prolonged contraction anyway. So we will all be doing ourselves a vast favor if we reduce our dependence on it anyway. Though it's going to be a little dramatic, I suspect, in the beginning. And we, as I've said, we may even find out as soon as the end of this year what that's going to start looking like. We must start producing locally, including local, reliable, renewable energy. One of the other newish programs that we've developed in the last year and a half, which I hope people here will find exciting, is the Energy Farms Network. It has become obvious to us, with the decline, particularly in liquid fuels, which is coming, that we will need to extend food farming into fuel, feedstock, fiber, and fertilizer, and where you've got it, as you have here, into control of your forests as well. We call this local energy farms, to stress that this is the antithesis, the very opposite of industrial biofuels, which are already wrecking the planet. They're taking out rainforests anew to plant palm trees, which are very high-bearing oil. They bear a lot of oil, which is being sent to Europe to turn into biodiesel. And this is just little short of criminal. In fact, it probably is criminal. It's a staggeringly bad idea. But we cannot just transition off liquid energy fuels. I hope no one dreams that we can overnight, and therefore we're going to need some substitutes. And if, like me, you incredibly dislike the idea of corn ethanol, which is another piece of near insanity for different reasons, and you dislike the idea of tearing out yet more rainforest to plant these palm oil trees, then reduce consumption of liquid fuels and start thinking about how to produce them locally. I mean, really locally. And I'll say a word about how you can produce some in your gardens, as we've started doing, but also on your farms. And there are many of you, I think, in the room or in the locale, are farmers. And we have to start thinking about producing fuel, feedstock, and fiber, even as we increase the amount of food we're producing. And I believe this is actually possible. But it will need more people on the land, taking very great care of the land, in fact, square foot by square foot. And in doing it that way, you can rejuvenate the soil and you can increase yields. But it's a lot of work. I don't try to minimize that. One of the ideas of this research demonstration is that we want to show that we can grow food and fuel locally at a small scale. And the idea is we want to spread this energy gardens idea as fast as we can. And it's caused remarkable interest at the local level. It's exciting. But even if you have a small patch, we've got some little boxes, 4 feet by 4 feet, to encourage people, even with the tiniest garden or even a balcony, that you too can start planting and growing something and learning about soil and compost and these vital activities. And we are growing oil seeds for biodiesel. We're growing sugar crops like a sugar beet and sorghum for the production of ethanol, and also biomass, and we're collecting some manure, including chicken manure, to put in our biogas digesters to research the making of biogas in a temperate zone. Now, what are we going to do with these crops? Well, the first important thing is they have stacked functions. They will do various things. Flax, for instance, produces a wonderful oil for human beings. The fiber can be turned into linen. For hundreds of years, linen was a staple for fabric, for making clothes and sheets and other things. And we're going to need to rediscover the marvelous properties of flax. You can also use it for composting. Other crops, almost all the crops we grow, which are possible fuel crops, are also possible food crops. With the idea that if we say to ourselves, look, we're short on food, we can't afford to make this sorghum or these Jerusalem artichokes into ethanol, for instance, we can eat them. But that's our decision. But in this case, we can't have our sorghum and eat it, as it were. You can't do both. Although you can compost it. There's a lot of things that you can do at the same time. But it will be our decision. And this is very important. If you are growing your own local biofuels, which are also possible foods as well, you can decide. But you will be deciding in the full knowledge that if I eat my biofuel, I can't also put it in my gas tank. So that'll be our decision. And surely, wouldn't you rather it was our decision than the decision of Archer Daniels Midlands? Because they don't care about us very much at all. Now, in terms of the relocalization of food, we must reduce or in some cases eliminate our use of oil and gas feedstocks. I hope we can all agree on this, though it'll give us problems at the large scale, and we don't shy away from this. We must reduce the use of inorganic fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides. It's toxified the whole planet. The use of genetically modified organisms I believe to be a scandal and a scourge and totally unnecessary. And also this pointless, destructive trading of similar foods. You get places in two regions that both produce apples and then they trade with them. And economists can prove to you that it actually makes the economy go faster. And the awful thing is it's true, but it also takes a lot of energy. And this is kind of one of the pointless practices we're going to have to stop engaging in. But beware, it could have economic effects. We are going to need to eat more vegetables. We need to try to reduce, to the extent that we can, our dependence on a heavily flesh-based diet. There are even medical studies which suggest that eating three giant portions of meat a day isn't very good for us. And it's certainly not very good for the planet. Of course, we should be producing local organic food and eating as seasonally as we possibly can. There will be benefits in terms of community and personal health, in terms of food security, and of course it will be a great benefit to local farmers and local gardeners too, and it will help replenish the soil. One of the tricky areas, which is less obvious and I think is going to be something that those of us that can and are interested must turn our minds to, is the relocalization of manufacturing. One suggestion we have is community-supported manufacturing. It's just one. The problem is that with so much of our vital stuff and goods being made in the Far East, it's economically non-viable to go back to local production at the moment, and we know that. So special things are going to have to be done to help bring back local manufacturing. Some of the things that we're going to have to look at, once again, food, the preserving of, the drying, the pickling of, fiber for making clothing, fabric, paper, rope, fire, I've called it somewhat whimsically. We need high temperatures for pottery and for glass, and of course also in foundries and for forging of metals. We are so dependent on metals. Metals are incredibly important to our lives, and I know that there are some people in the community that know how to work metals. We must value our metal workers a great deal more, and I encourage people to learn about metals. And one of the other things which some of you in this room must have already thought about and perhaps already do is we must learn once again to fix and repair things. But by the way, fixing and repairing many of the things which are made now in our daily lives is not very easy. I mean, even to fix this microphone, if it went wrong, wouldn't be easy. And to fix this computer would be nigh on impossible, and virtually every other object that you can imagine that's got a high level of technical design and production in it. And that's one of the things about relocalizing production. We need to encourage people to design things and make things locally. And when you've designed something and made it yourself or in collaboration with your colleagues, you've got a much higher chance of knowing how to fix it. And this is going to become really vital in the future. There will be more time with family and with friends and community as there was in the past. There is bound to be, because sharing and working together makes that happen. One of the other difficult subjects which has a sketchy and patchy past is that of local money and local currency. I've looked at this quite a lot over the last few years and been involved with some of the pioneers of it, and I remain convinced that we must take local currency seriously. And we in California are doing some experiments with some renewable energy-backed currency, actually starting with some things called carbon coupons, and we're actually asking people to give us their kitchen food scraps, and in return for them, we will give them carbon coupons. Because in each kilogram of food scraps, there may be as much as 4 megajoules of energy. And if you think that in a gallon of gasoline, there's about 130 megajoules of energy, there, that shows you that there's quite a lot of energy, even in just a pound or two, a kilogram or so, of humble food scraps. And we think this is a very exciting idea, because everybody has food scraps, and we can take those food scraps and feed them to our compost heaps and our biogas digesters and our chickens, and then we can sell them back via using the same payment method of these carbon coupons as eggs or as soil, and as eventually some kind of energy. Biogas is not so easy to bottle, but it's all part of the system. So this is very interesting, and we'll be reporting on how this goes. We think this has a chance of establishing a local currency, because we can start really, really small. So often local currencies need to start big. And I'm not against that idea, if only it can work. And I'm very interested in planting small seeds. Start with what you've got. Start from where you are and build on that. One of the intriguing things about a renewable energy-backed currency is it'll help you to tune your economy to what your solar income actually is. And that's something that we really are going to need a lot more help to do, because our economies are attuned to fossil fuels, and you can see where that's got us. A very tricky area, at least on a large scale, to relocalize is education, because we don't have much control, at least most of us, over our education, at least our formal education. I believe that the spread of misinformation and downright indoctrination has reached epidemic proportions in so many parts of the world, including here. There's been this not surprising but horribly erroneous focus on growth. And, of course, there's been a corporatization of the education system in all parts, including at the university and even in the high schools and junior schools. What we need to produce are curricula based on different aspects of relocalization, of what the locale needs. We need to produce people who have the skills in designing and making and repairing vital things. And the benefits would be informed citizens prepared for a relocalized post-carbon world, and also prepared to do a much better form of democracy as well, which doesn't work very well with uninformed citizens. And we need to increase the awareness all through our system, through education, of community resource use and needs.
Julian Darley of the Post-Carbon Institute speaking in July in Nelson, British Columbia. You can find out more about the Post-Carbon Institute's various projects at postcarbon.org. Thanks to the Deconstructing Dinner Show for that tape. I can strongly recommend their show, which is focused on food security. Check it out at deconstructingdinner.org. And if you have a relocalization group or want to start one, please send me info and I'll announce it on the air. Email me at unwelcome@radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.net. Or you can email me through the show website, unwelcomeguests.org. That's guests with an S. Where you can also download archived MP3s of the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
My guns and my saddle will all